Which brings us to a new and possibly more environmentally friendly way to produce oil. It involves plastic, you know, like those soda bottles you discard. Only 7% of plastic waste in the U.S. is recycled each year, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, a startup company in Niagara Falls says it can increase that amount while also reducing the country's dependence on foreign oil. For member station WBFO, Daniel Robison has more.
This machine's known as the plastic eating monster. Thousands of pounds of shredded milk jugs, water bottles, and grocery bags tumble into a large tank where it's melted together and vaporized. This waste comes from landfills and dumps from all over the United States.
Basically, they've been mining their own piles for us and sending them here.
John Bordnick runs his namesake company, JBI Inc. He's invented a process that converts plastic into oil by rearranging its hydrocarbon chains. According to tests by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, JBI's patented technology is efficient, with close to 90% of plastics coming out as fuel. Bordnick says that makes the case for this kind of recycling to go mainstream.
When there have been attempts in the past to make fuel from plastic, it's been a low quality, low flash point, kind of sludgy. In this case here, we're making a very highly refined, consistent product that's within specifications of any standardized fuel.
JBI executive Bob Moladinha points to a spout at the other end of the plastic eating machine dripping a thin brown liquid.
You could tap this right now and this is ready to go. That's a number six fuel. That's what a lot of like U.S. Steel uses, a lot of major companies. That's what they pay the big bucks for, right there.
Each barrel of oil costs about $10 to produce, which JBI can sell for around $100 through a national distributor. The young company is already producing a few thousand gallons of oil a day. They've signed lucrative deals to set up operations next to companies with large volumes of plastic waste. But in its rush to grow, JBI has been accused by the SEC of overvaluing some of its assets in order to raise more funds. And John Bordnick says it's been hard to find acceptance from potential oil buyers because JBI's product has been dubbed a green fuel.
We don't make a synthetic other product that has problems. We make an in-spec fuel like everyone else. In fact, if anything, the word alternative has a stigma attached to it, more so because of prior attempts.
If JBI has its way, plastics will become a significant source of domestic fuel that reduces the country's dependence on foreign oil. But just how green is JBI's recycling when it produces a fossil fuel that pollutes just like any other?
To enter themselves into this industry, I think that they've all bought into the idea of producing a fuel.
Carson Maxted is with Resource Recycling, the plastic recycling industry's trade journal. He's not sure whether converting plastic to oil can be considered recycling or even environmentally friendly. But he says JBI's methods can coexist and even complement current recycling practices.
So they're getting value from something that would otherwise go to the landfill because the plastics most of them are looking for, the plastics that are either not easily recycled, they're of low quality or mixed plastic types, or they're dirty, things that wouldn't be accepted into a recycler.
And since there's no lack of plastic supply or demand for oil, Maxted says this technology has the potential to transform both industries. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Robison in Buffalo, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. What makes people creative? How is it that some people can make things that make the rest of us applaud or marvel at, sometimes for centuries? The writer Jonah Lehrer, whose specialty is neuroscience, addresses that question in his new book, Imagine. Lehrer defines creativity broadly. The creations he considers range from masking tape to Broadway musicals and breakthroughs in mathematics, from memorable ad campaigns to Shakespearean tragedies, and he finds that the conditions that favor creativity are equally broad. Our brains, our times, our buildings, our cities. Jonah Lehrer, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first, can we really find common explanations for the success of the inventor of masking tape and Shakespeare, or are we lumping together apples, oranges, kiwi fruit, and much else?
Well, I think we absolutely can lump them all together. I think creativity, I think one of the mistakes we've made in talking about creativity is we've assumed it's a single verb, that when people are creative, they're just doing one particular kind of thinking. By looking at creativity from the perspective of the brain, we can see that creativity is actually a bundle of distinct mental processes. And so how we think, whether you're writing a Shakespearean tragedy or trying to come up with a new graphic design or writing a piece of software, that how we think about the problem should depend on the problem itself, that creativity is really a catch-all term for a variety of very different kinds of thinking.
I mentioned our buildings in the introduction. When Steve Jobs was at Pixar, you write, he was convinced that the layout of the building could either foster or impede creativity, where the restrooms were.
Yeah, and the original design for the Pixar Studios consisted of three separate buildings where they'd put the computer scientists in one building and the animators in a second building, and the third building would contain everybody else, the directors, the editors, and so on. And Steve realized that that was a terrible idea, that the real challenge of Pixar was getting people from these different cultures, these computer scientists and these cartoonists, to work together, to really collaborate. And so he insisted that Pixar Studios just be one vast cavernous space. And then he started moving everything to the atrium. So he started moving the mailboxes there and the cafe and the restaurant. And finally, and this was his last big idea, he insisted there'd be only two bathrooms in the entire Pixar Studios and that these would be in the central space. And of course, this is very inconvenient. No one wants to have to walk 15 minutes to go to the bathroom. And yet Steve insisted that this is the one place everyone has to go every day. And now you can talk to people at Pixar and they all have their bathroom story. They all talk about the great conversation they had while washing their hands.
Because he wanted there to be places where people who were trying to be creative would encounter other people who were trying to be creative.
Exactly. He wanted there to be mixing. He knew that the human friction makes the sparks, and that when you're talking about a creative endeavor that requires people from different cultures to come together, you have to force them to mix. That our natural tendency is to stay isolated, to talk to people who are just like us, who speak our private languages, who understand our problems, but that's a big mistake. And so his design was to force people to come together, even if it was just going to be in the bathroom.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the prefrontal cortex and the notion that being creative sometimes is not so much a matter of harnessing the brain as in getting the brain out of its harness.
Well, the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain just behind the forehead. And it's often referred to as the uniquely human part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that got greatly enlarged during human evolution. And it's essential for something called working memory, which is when you're focused on a task, when you're trying to go through edits on a poem or perfect a design or go over a draft after draft of a symphony. This is the part of the brain you're engaging.
But when our prefrontal cortex goes off the job just lets our brains run free, well, we all do that every night, right? This is what happens when we're dreaming, for example.
Yes. So then the question becomes, well, what happens if you hit the wall? Because we've all got experience with this, right? You're working on a creative problem, and then all of a sudden that feeling of progress disappears. And here's where I think the science was somewhat surprising to me. What you should do then when you hit the wall is get away from your desk. Mm-hmm. Step away from the office, take a long walk, daydream, find some way to relax. Get those alpha waves. Alpha waves are a signal in the brain that's closely correlated with states of relaxation. And what scientists have found is that when people are relaxed, they're much more likely to have those big aha moments, those moments of insight where these seemingly impossible problems get solved. So when you hit the wall, the best thing you can do is probably take a very long, warm shower. The answer will only arrive once you stop looking for it.
Okay. We are raised on the idea that creativity means being original. But time and again in your book, you return to the idea that creativity entails, at its most polite, horizontal patterns of sharing ideas to more commonly just stealing ideas from other people. Is a central element of creativity noticing other stuff that other people have done and using it?
Yeah, I think it's where the brain can actually help illuminate the essence of creativity. The brain is just an endless knot of connections. And a creative thought is simply two cells, a network that's connecting itself in a new way. That sometimes it's triggered by a misreading of an old novel. Sometimes it's triggered by a random thought walking down the street or bumping into someone in the bathroom of the studio. There are all sorts of ways, seemingly old ideas can get reassembled in a new way.
One of the strangest patterns of a creative process that you relate in the book, I thought, was the story of the ad man who came up with the big Nike Just Do It campaign and the phrase, just do it. And he explains how that phrase came to mind, and no one would have expected it.
Yeah, this is a great story from Dan Wyden at Wyden Kennedy, the the very honored Portland ad firm, and he tells this great story on he come up with 7 videos for the new Nike ad campaign, and this in the mid-'80s. But he knew these different videos, which featured different sports, needed a shared slogan. But he just couldn't think of the slogan. And so he had held all these group meetings with people all throughout the day that held these conversations. And at some point during the day, somebody must have mentioned Norman Mailer to him. And so Norman Mailer was in the back of his head somewhere. And so it's near midnight. His deadline's approaching. He's really, really frustrated at this point because he can't come up with this damn slogan. And then suddenly he thinks of Norman Mailer. And he remembers Norman Mailer wrote this book called The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. And he remembers Gary Gilmore's last words right before he's executed by a firing squad in Utah. His last words were, "Let's do it." And Dan Wine thinks to himself, geez, that's pretty brave. That's a pretty brave sentiment to have right before you die. Just get it over with. But he realizes "let's do it" isn't quite right. So he tweaks one word. And there you get "just do it." That's where "just do it" came from. But that's a perfect example of how, you know, in a sense, that's an old idea. It was a line in a Norman Mailer book, and he tweaked it ever so slightly, substituted one word, and came up with one of the most influential advertising slogans of the second half of the 20th century.
Joan O'Lehrer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joan O'Lehrer's new book is called Imagine: How Creativity Works. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And today's last word in business takes us to the competition in the restaurant industry. Analysts are forecasting modest gains for that industry in 2012 after a tough couple of years. So many people didn't have money to eat out. A few more do now. And Taco Bell is among the chains making some dramatic moves to get your attention. As NPR's Allison Keyes reports, Taco Bell plans to spend around $75 million advertising a new and surprising type of taco, the Doritos Locos taco.
Yes, may I have you?
Taco Bell is celebrating its 50th anniversary this week, and it's getting big buzz from a new product.
One Dorito Taco Supreme.
Yep, that's a Doritos Locos taco with shells made from nacho cheese Doritos. Some might be skeptical of such a pairing, but not Robert Mack of New Jersey.
I love Doritos, I love Taco Bell, and having them both at the same time, why didn't someone think of that sooner?
NPR watched as he took his first bite.
It's really good. Best of both worlds.
It's everything that you dreamed it would be.
Yes, it is.
Taco Bell manager Tita Funa says the tacos are a hot item.
More men is buy the Doritos tacos.
So I think it's having breadth of appeal.
Greg Creed is Taco Bell's CEO and says brands like his want to differentiate themselves from others in the marketplace, partly by having a lot of new ideas that will appeal to their customers, to new customers, and create new expectations for a known brand.
It's really about, on multiple platforms and multiple layers, being very innovative.
Just when you thought all the really good ideas were taken. Introducing the new Doritos Locos Tacos from Taco Bell.
You can't miss the TV ads for the new tacos, but other companies are trying to boost their shares, too.
I had a shamrock shake.
I hate you.
Yep, Subway broke the 200-calorie breakfast barrier.
When it comes to innovation, we've seen some terrific products come out.
Kurt Schnabelt is a director in the restaurant and food service practice with the global consulting firm Alex Partners. He says companies are finding ways to deliver products in ways people don't expect, from Burger King testing a delivery service in the Washington, D.C. area, too.
Things like White Castle offering wine in their restaurants, Starbucks offering wine. You know, these are ways for these brands to increase their sales.
Schnabelt adds it's also a way to do so during times when the eateries had been getting light volume. But no matter what crazy things restaurants might be trying, including a growing focus on social media, Schnabelt says.
Food quality is still the number one thing that consumers want out of a restaurant.
Oh, and that wine at White Castle thing? Only happening at one store in Lafayette, Indiana. For now, Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Cheers. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Julie Rovner joins me in the studio right now. And Julie, we've just heard about one person in Massachusetts who has health coverage and another in Texas who doesn't. First question, how many of us, like Melinda Marouf in Houston, are uninsured?
Well, like everything in healthcare, that is subject to a good bit of debate. But the last official numbers that we have from the Census Bureau said that in 2010, that number was 49 million, which is about one-sixth of the country.
Since the population is now a little bit over 300 million, how many Americans are then on the big government health care programs, Medicaid, Medicare, or military coverage?
Well, there's some people who have both, but generally it's a little bit north of about 100 million people.
It's about a third of the entire population.
That's right. So that's a lot of people who are on a what you would think of as a government health program.
But there are other people whose health insurance is, in effect, paid for with tax monies because they're public employees.
That's right. There's about 28 million people who work for either the federal government or state or local government. These are not just federal workers, but teachers, firefighters, police officers. So if you add all of those people together, you get somewhere over 40% of the population whose health insurance is basically paid for by a governmental entity. That's why if you look at total government spending in 2010, the government share of health spending was $1.2 trillion of the $2.6 trillion that we spent, or about 45% of all health care spending. So there's an awful lot of government spending on the nation's health care tab.
Let's look at the rest of the economy, Americans who work in the private sector and are insured by the private sector.
That's right. That's everything that's left. That's a little bit less than 40%, and that includes people who buy their own health insurance.
So whatever you can say about our healthcare system, and it's a very complex thing to describe, one thing it is not is a predominantly private system.
That's correct.
Okay, Julie, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're talking about our healthcare system on All Things Considered from NPR News.
If you like your TV programs with complex characters, tightly written scripts, with one foot firmly planted in the real world, then you are probably a fan of Homeland.
Last night at 2300, two UH-60 Black Hawk gunships lit the target with over 8,000 rounds. During the sweep, one of the Deltas found something else.
I'm an American.
But what you might not know is that American TV show Homeland, which airs on Showtime, is based on a hit Israeli television series. That connection is being honored at the Israel Film Festival, which is currently underway in Los Angeles. The festival is in its 26th year, and more than 30 titles are showcased this year, with everything from feature-length films to documentaries and student shorts and all kinds of subjects, including, and we really need to hear more about this, a film about a Mexican salsa dancer disguised as a nun. Here to tell us more about all this is the founder and executive director of the Israel Film Festival, Meir Fenigstein. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, so much of the news out of Israel, especially, you know, now, pertains to political conflict. But we notice that the subject matter of the festival is quite diverse. Has it always been that way?
It changed with the years. Now it's a little bit different what it used to be. 10-20 years ago when I started the festival, we showed a lot of films about the conflict, about the Israeli army. We don't have those films anymore. Most of the films are personal films, and that's why, as you mentioned, we have films like Salsa Tel Aviv or My Australia that is 70% in Polish. And Salsa Tel Aviv is 70% in Spanish.
Well, we have to talk about Salsa Tel Aviv. It is about a, let me make sure I have this right, it's about a Mexican salsa dancer who disguises herself as a nun who goes to Israel to work so she can send money home. But what develops is a love story. And we'll play a short clip.
Welcome to Israel.
En español, por favor. Gracias. Ustedes van a Tel Aviv?
Well, you get a flavor there. what did you like about this film?
First of all, it's a telenovela. It's, you know, it's not exactly a film, you know. And what's interesting about this is that director Jorge Valle decided to make a film. He's Argentinian. He made what they call Aliyah to Israel, came to Israel about 20 years ago. And this is his first feature film. And the actors, the star of the film is Angelica Valle. She's a very, very famous in telenovela in Mexico. Her mother is playing too. Her name is Angelica Maria, and she is like the Miss, the sweetheart of Mexico. And this is a, you know, the connection, the cultural exchange between Spanish and Hebrew, or, you know, if you can say between the Latin community and the Israeli community. That's what intrigued me to show this film in the festival.
You also have documentaries, as I said, and they deal with some, I don't know, how can we just say this, some difficult subjects, both personal and political subjects. One in particular that caught my eye was 77 Steps. Will you tell me about that and tell me why you like this film?
I really wanted to mention another film that I was more intrigued in 77 Steps, if you don't mind, is The Dolphin Boy. Because The Dolphin Boy is a film about an Arab Israeli that was bitten by his friend or in his neighborhood, and he was so hard bitten that he was basically out of, you know, he was not a human being anymore. And his Israeli doctor decided to take him to a treatment that is unusual, to take him to Eilat, is the city south of Israel that has a dolphin area, and he was there for 3 years and was swimming with the dolphin and got in love with the dolphin. He couldn't say one word, and after 3 years he came back and came back to his family, and this all because of the dolphin. And I think this is a very, very powerful film, and I really recommend people to see this film because it's really fascinating.
What do you like about it?
The relationship, how somebody can you know, get related to a fish, basically to a dolphin, and through his love and the relationship with the dolphin, he gets cured. It's amazing. Mm.
We're talking about the Israel Film Festival. It's currently running in Los Angeles. With us is the founder and executive director of the festival, Meir Fenigstein. Tell me about how, again, we were talking at the beginning of our conversation about how the festival has sort of changed over the years. What are some of the things that you've tried to do with it over the years as you've developed it? And what gave you the idea to begin with?
First of all, my background is I used to be in a rock band. I used to be a drummer in a group called Kaveret, or Beehives. My nickname is Poogie, P-O-O-G-Y. And this group is known in Israel as the Beatles of Israel. And this group was established in the beginning of the 70s. From the music side, I decided to go to study in Berklee College of Music in Boston. And there, where I came with the idea of the festival in 1983, that I want to change for music after I've been already performing before 400,000 people in Tel Aviv, to do something else, and I wanted to stay in the United States, and decided to bring Israeli films to America because I thought it's very important to showcase Israeli culture in America.
Well, what do you think is important to showcase, though? I mean, a lot of Americans go back and forth. I mean, is it, you know, they go back and forth. People have family ties and so forth. Is it part of what you're hoping people will see is what, beyond the headlines or the vibrancy of the culture?
Absolutely.
As it continues?
Absolutely. That's really what it is. It's beyond the headlines. And I think that because, you know, through the internet, everybody wants to know a little bit more personal stuff about the other cultures now. It used to be that everybody, you know, when we didn't have the internet, we didn't want to know. Now you can just put something and be in Italy right now, in Venice, and see what you want to see in Venice or know, or speak Italian or, you know, any language. But what I'm saying is that the festival gives an opportunity to the public, and it doesn't matter if they are Jewish, Israeli, or anybody, to view the Israeli society in the best way, in the real way. And that's, I think, it's very, very important, not just for Israel, for any country.
Before we let you go, I did want to ask why you felt it was important and why the festival is honoring the American television show Homeland, which, as we said, is based on a hit Israeli series. Why do you think that's important? Because some people would say, well, you're copying me.
It's not exactly copying. This showed kind of a connection between the Israeli television and the American television, because they basically bought the rights for the miniseries Chatufim. It's an Israeli miniseries, and they showed it in, and they created Homeland from that. And this was very important for the festival to really emphasize this point, that there is a real connection between the Hollywood community and the Israeli film community.
Meir Fenigstein is the founder and executive director of the Israel Film Festival, which is now in its 26th year. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Mr. Fenigstein, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
We are sorry to report that Lehigh is out of the NCAA tournament. They lost in the second round after a huge upset of Duke in the first. Murray State is gone, too. But as the tournament gets down to 16 teams, one of those teams is Ohio University. Traditionally not one of the powerhouse teams we talk about year in, year out. In fact, it's been more than four decades, 48 years to be precise, since the school has made it this far in the tournament. NPR's Mike Pesca reports on the team's quest.
With 15 seconds left in Ohio's game against South Florida, Roderick McDavis is kneeling in the front row of Nashville's Bridgestone Arena. Not in prayer, but like a runner in the starting blocks.
Come on, DJ! Let's punch this ticket!
DJ Cooper, listed at 5'11", but who stands level with this 6-foot-tall reporter's eyebrows, is at the free throw line. His recently converted pair of free throws has just put his team up 5. Now he's trying to put the game out of reach. He misses the first, but makes the second.
There it is. There it is. Ball game.
Roderick McDavis is, of course, right. He does have a doctorate. In fact, he's Ohio University's president. Before the Bobcats overcame South Florida to earn a spot in the Sweet 16, the Athens, Ohio school was best known as being the nation's number one party school, a title the president is not proud of, a designation guard Nick Kellogg refers to as a stigma. But the student body has earned its reverie, in no small part because the players have been careful not to do much celebrating of their own. 2 years ago, the Bobcats pulled another tournament upset, but then lost by 15 in the next round. After last night's game, Ohio head coach John Gross mentioned one way he learned from his tournament experience.
2 years ago, I really felt like after the first round win that I didn't do a very good job of helping them avoid distractions.
So this year, after a few moments to tweet, text, and return some calls, the coaching staff confiscated the team's phones.
Not one guy, and that's how I knew this team's really locked in, not one single guy complained.
Gross did not take this team to the regional semifinals on telecom blackouts alone. He's a basketball lifer, a former assistant to Thad Matta at Ohio State, a former colleague of Sean Miller, now of Arizona, and Butler's Brad Stevens.
And I owe those guys a lot. Many of those guys are on what I call my advisory board now. You know, guys I talk to a lot still, Sean, Thad, Brad. I talk to Brad a lot, you know, bounce ideas off of them. So I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, that's a heck of an advisory board.
From Matta, he learned how to perform against the top level of competition. Stevens and Gross often discuss the intricacies of statistics, giving rise to comments like this from Devon Washington, who was among a group of former players at last night's game.
Oh, man, Coach Gross is a genius, man. That's all. He's just a genius.
Ohio's current roster is the usual island of misfit toys that characterize mid-major programs. The guard that was too short in Cooper, and the blue-chip player who transferred out of a big school to get playing time, Walter Offit. Ohio's other starters typically ranked 50th to 70th best at their position when coming out of high school, but they've learned, grown, and matured. Their next opponent, the University of North Carolina, has a roster entirely composed of the type of 4- and 5-star recruits who would never consider an Ohio school that didn't have the word state after it. Facing the Tar Heels is no party, which this particular group of Ohio undergrads is fine with. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Nashville.